Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. And with us this week, we have Merlin McCormack. Hello.
Good morning, Sam. How are you?
Very good. Very good. For those that have not come across you before, I think we're almost reaching the end of this by at some point because you've been on it. This is probably three times,
maybe. I think
it's the
first time,
like
yeah.
If you want to know Merlin's sort of story and how this business has sort of built up a little bit, you can go and check out the earlier podcast, which I'll put in the description. But for those of you that have not come across you, can you just give like a 2-second summary of who you are, what we do, and sort of where we are, I guess?
Yeah, so we're sat in our building in Brentford in West London. We've got a classic car and supercar dealership come hub, and it houses a multitude of businesses of all kind of industries, a lot of automotive. So we've got detailers on site, restoration business, storage site, and as well as hospitality stuff. So we have a wine and cocktail bar, event space, pizza restaurant, coffee shop. What else have we got? Yeah, pub. There's about 55 businesses here now. And we've also extended out. We have 4 other smaller sites in the area, Brentford and Richmond.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. So we're up to about 80 of these creative workspaces. So that is everything from the customer-facing stuff, as aforementioned, and also office space, artist studios, music studios, things like that.
Oh, cool. Because I know someone was asking me about this site recently, and I was trying to think because there's a fixed timeline on this place. Yeah. Isn't there?
the thing that keeps me awake at night. So we were supposed to be here for about 18 to 24 months. We took the space on in 2019, and we have had state of execution after state of execution. COVID followed by financial crises have set back the developer's plans to demolish and build on the site. We had it on a meanwhile use basis. We still do, but we've been very lucky in terms of how delayed things have been from our side. I don't think they're quite so happy about it, but that's the way of the world. We are coming towards the end of it, though. The kind of finish line's in sight. We will be moving into our new site regardless in spring and fitting that out and opening for summer next year.
Have you said where that is going to be?
So this is kind of all being drip fed at the moment because we're still in the kind of design process of it. But the site itself is secured. We've got a site about 500 meters away, still under the same developer, Ballymore, the Brentford project. They've done an amazing job and been really, really incredible to us in helping us find a new space. It's taking over about a fifth of a multi-story car park. The ground floor levels, It's literally around the corner. So the ground floor levels are a combination of what was destined to be public parking. So we're privatizing that. And then on the south side of the car park, it's completely riverfronted. It's awesome. It's got its own little private terrace. You've got this triple height retail space that we've taken on as part of the showroom that was destined to be a boat storage facility with snackers in. So obviously it's a huge cavernous space. that was, again, going to house boats. So it's perfect for us to then come in and put a shop front on it. We're going to have nice triple height glazing concertinas.
Yeah.
In the summer, it'd be awesome because we can spill out onto the waterside. Still host the car meets. We've then taken over some space up on the upper levels of the car park. So we've got this open air rooftop, about 14,000 square foot on the roof. The most insane views of where we're situated at the moment, south facing, obviously the best view. There's nothing that's going to get developed. So we've got like Kew Gardens, Richmond Park, Park. So you've got this insane vista that takes you all the way over to, you know, you see the cliche Shard and Canary Wharf and London Eye and whatever else. And we do a lot of filming work up there. We hire it out for film location work. That'll become a kind of destination space for our car meets and events and stuff.
Okay.
Then during the wetter months, we can do it on the internal levels of the car park further down. We're also going to open a car storage facility in there. So we'll have, based on what we've got already, we'll have an additional 40 spaces on top of what we already offer for secure car storage. We'll be taking quite a few of the businesses that are with us either over into the car park or into an adjacent building that we've taken next door as well. So there's some of the creative workspaces and tenants. So trying to keep the community that we've built alive.
Yeah.
Naturally, it can't be replicated. Certainly not in the same footprint that we've got here. I think there's about a 20,000 square foot disparity between current and the future. But the future place is, you know, permanent. It's on a very long lease and we can kind of relax into it and make it our own. The factory where we're sat at the moment, the building that's, you know, with the impending doom, because we only thought we were going to have it for 18 months. And frankly, because it was all we could afford to do at the time, we built it to a standard. To last for a couple of years at best. So we spent the last 3 years, you know, patching holes and keeping on top of it. And people have been amazingly sympathetic through it. And I think that kind of adds to the charm and the character of the place. And they can see that the bigger picture, but it drives me crazy because I want it to all be perfect. So the new place will be a completely different vibe. My girlfriend, George, is behind the interior design of the place and she's going to be kind of keeping me in check on what it can and can't be. It's going to be a complete rebrand essentially when we open as well.
That must be, is it like you're looking into the future and obviously there's all this, you've built it up through the various stages. This is site number two.
This is site number three for the front facing stuff, but we've had lots of sort of satellite properties as well along the way. But the first site we had was down at Kew Bridge under what's now the new Brentford Football Club Stadium. So we rented the space off of Brentford Football Club for about, you're just shy of 2 years when we first started up. Beautiful old 1890s warehouse, like stable building. But we could get a real cramming push, nine cars in there.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then that's where we started like the classics and cake meets. We shared the yard that we had out the front with the wood recycling plant. So the dust down there, horrific. And then we moved in with Valleymore to the first site that we had with them, which is now a block of flats next door. And that's just kind of, we've grown from there. And they saw the kind of, the way we were repurposing the buildings that we were having off of them. So they kept giving us more and more and more of these meanwhile use buildings until they needed them back to develop them. So we've been able to grow our portfolio of tenants during that time and expand on it being a destination for the car community and the local community too.
Yeah, it's been really cool seeing it grow over time, like since that.
Oh, thank you, man.
I don't know whether it was there. I remember some sort of, was it a classics and cake, or it could have even been like an opening night or something at the first venue in the small little building. And then when you came here and you're like, we've got all this space, but like, I don't know what we're going to do with it.
Yeah.
And it's like, kind of needs looking after a bit. And then you've just like filled it out. And then
we've literally rented out every cupboard under the stairs.
And each time I come back, I look and go, oh no, you've somehow like, another space has been created within this space. Like there's a hairdresser in an airstream outside now.
Yeah, he's great, Timothy. It's again though, having something like that gives people, majority of his clientele, 40 to 60 year old women who would never really per se have much. They're not necessarily car people. They wouldn't have a real meaning to come down here, reason to come down here, and it brings in a whole new lease of life. And there's no separation really between us and them. Because we've got the coffee shop situated with the showroom, it's like a sort of gateway for them to come in. And we're not trying to sell them cars. It's just trying to get everyone in and around this sort of immersive experience of it. And it's funny to see how their attitude towards it initially can sometimes be quite, questioning why they're coming to the old derelict warehouse in Brentford. And it's so heartwarming to see how they all warm to the space itself.
Yeah, because the initial sort of impression as you're coming in, it's like part of this massive development. And now the entrance has changed. That confused me this morning. And you turn up and you're like, okay, there's a lot of cars and stuff. And then you sort of, I'd come in through the cars. So it was always like, yeah, fine. I sort of knew about it. But yeah, as a random person, I can see
you. It's like, a bit chaotic.
I want to go to get a coffee from Coffeeology. Okay, right. And then you start everything, as you say, it's like massively integrated. Has your, like what you do day to day, because I know originally it was sort of the cars and selling cars, and then you started sort of subletting tenants. Apologies for the cars driving around, but sort of the nature,
adds to the character.
Nature of the place. And now you're saying, you know, you've got multiple sites, managing so many different tenants. What are you now doing sort of day to day, and what's in your head in terms of what have you got to deal with?
I'm really lucky to have an incredible team of people around me. So that kind of helps prop up a lot of the management of the bolt-on businesses.
Yeah.
So the, like I said, the tenanted space is a full-time job in itself to manage that. So we've got someone who does that. We do a hell of a lot of like film and photography location work.
Mm.
So at any one time, we probably have 3 days out of five of the working week with something going on at one of the sites. All the other properties we've got are period interesting spaces as well. None of these are like new build prefab offices or anything like that. So, I mean, today, for instance, we've got a particular online search engine filming at our place in Richmond.
Oh, cool.
They've been there for 3 days and we live in part of it. So we've been staying in a hotel for the last 2 nights. It kicked us out of the house. But that's, again, a full-time job for somebody. So Luke runs that. And sales is still a huge focus of my, that's where I portion a lot of my time to.
Yeah.
So in terms of consigning and selling the cars, but then things like the management of the online marketing and that, getting the stock online, writing the copy for the photos. So Charles, who's working with us, does a lot of our photography and helps with the online management and stuff. And we work with a couple of copywriters who help us write the adverts, or if not, I'll write them. And storage, again, another job for somebody else. So it's just trying to kind of delegate as best possible, without A, being too much of a control freak over how it's done, but B, making sure that the kind of the voice of the brand isn't lost. And we're not, there's no brand that we're sat here that dictated by. It's just, I don't ever want it to become a polished, another space that's lost within a kind of saturated market. I think it's not for everyone, and we're never trying to appease everyone, but equally we kind of aware that we don't ever want to become some sort of sellout brand type experience. It's still kind of like a very informal, personable place that we're not motivated by much beyond trying to keep this car scene alive. As long as we can make a few quid along the way, we're happy.
Yeah. Do you think when you move to the new space, is it going to be a bit more, well, it's going to be a bit more polished?
It's going to have to be. it will be more polished, and we will have to, we're going to be shifting a lot of, for instance, the sales stuff that we do, we're going to be focusing that a bit more on certain cars, just because we are then restricted on the space that we've got. We've also got the cobbler who's joined us downstairs with his hammer. He's still very prevalent, as you can tell. I mean, this is quite an authentic, immersive podcast.
It really is. It is. It's like, okay, you've got some cars we're out there, you've got the cobbler.
It's a hive of activity.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the dog to start barking.
We haven't got any coffee machines today.
No, that's usually the next thing.
Coffee not open. So in that the car park space, the various spaces within that, are you going to have some of these businesses? Are they going to be there in there as well?
Yeah. So we're going to be opening a new dedicated food space. So wait and see how that pans out. It's going to be a bit different from the food offering we've got here. Santa Maria is sadly leaving us as we vacate this place, so they're going off, they're thinning down their sort of locations. So I think we've had a great run of it with them, but equally I think I'm really keen to kind of bring some new life into the space and different offering that's still kind of as universally adored like pizza is. But I think what we've got in mind should be, I think it's going to work actually, it could work even better. We still have the coffee shop, Plonkers, the wine and cocktail bar will still dominate the sort of frontage of the space, especially with it being river frontage in the summer, that we can spill out onto the cobbles. And that's then going to be the side of the business that still hosts these private events and parties and whatever else. So at the moment we're doing one or two a week of these, be it birthday parties or private corporate events. Tomorrow night we've got Classic Driver here hosting their 25th anniversary.
And oh, nice.
If you're around, come on down. I think you should have had an invite, but
Maybe. thanks for the invite. I can never make anything these days. When I looked at the diary of like sort of the events now going on, you have so many things and different varieties. Plonker's Wine Bar, is that an evolution? I think last time I was here, it definitely didn't look like it looked now. It was a space. There was definitely some wine activity.
Yeah,
the same thing that's evolved, or is it different?
It occupies the same space. But we started off initially by trying to open a bottle shop, wine shop. To be blunt, there wasn't the footfall for it in Brentford yet. Mm-hmm. With the development kind of coming to a head now, I think if we opened it now, we'd probably be all right. But within 6 months of it being open, it became quite apparent that we opened in the evenings as a bottle shop, as a bar.
Yeah.
And that was hugely popular. But the bottle shop side of it, trying to be a retail,
didn't really work.
I'm happy to admit that, you learn along the way, right? But what it then taught us was that there was a huge demand for a new bar in the area, something that could be like as flexible as it is. So it's contained within about a 500 square foot space that can spill out into the car showroom. So we clear out a lot of the cars for these events, and we can fence off everything so everything's still secure and safe, but it frees up this huge sort of 2,000 square foot dance floor, for want of a better statement, a better word. We've got a huge glitter ball above it now, a purpose-built DJ booth. And so it's a total turnkey party space. So that's become its own kind of business. It's one of the few things that I wanted to keep in-house as well. So a lot of the other businesses are obviously tenanted or joint ventures or partnerships. Plonkers is sort of exclusively mine because I wanted to have the kind of control over what went on here after hours. And it's worked really well. We've got an amazing team behind that as well. Again, Georgia was behind the interior design of the new space, done an amazing job with that.
Yeah, it looks pretty sick.
That's a kind of good nod and hint to what the new space is going to be like throughout.
I'm very excited to see what this new place is going to be, because if you take that, and you can have a look on the website and see what it looks like, et cetera, if you're listening. But if you take that sort of vibe, a little bit of that vibe in here, but not quite the same, and then take that into like a proper venue, which it will be on the riverfront,
and with the cars in and around, it's going to be cool
experience to anywhere else.
I think this is, and we're not trying to do that thing of like this has to be so different from everything, we can't be the same as whatever. Obviously we're inspired by a lot of stuff that's been and gone and exists today, but ultimately we want a bigger and better focus on the cars. The way that the building's also laid out here has been a logistical nightmare. The fact we're moving into what is a purpose-built car park, for me to get cars in and out of it, is going to be a dream compared to what we've got. The noise in the background at the moment is them using the car lift to get yet another car upstairs.
Right,
This morning, for instance, we've had a customer phone us, he's bought a car. I'll pick it up at some point. So we've stored it down the back of the showroom. I want it now. And we've had to move 12 cars up and down. It's 5 minutes a car on the lift. And so if everyone who's just started with us to help manage the storage stuff, I mean, he's got a full-time job basically moving these things around.
Yeah.
Which is good. We needed it. But the space will be a bit better laid out and functional for us. It's going to make things a lot more efficient. Looking forward.
I presume the plans are going in enough. Is fitting out a car park, does it have some issues?
Mm.
I know you've dealt with a lot of stuff doing this, so you've learned a lot, but
we've got away with a lot here, to be blunt, because the building was sort of scheduled for demolition. So there's a lot of things that obviously we've had to comply to, like building regulations and fire controls and health and safety planning wise, it all meets its
what it needs to do.
What it needs to do with it being a car park, and with the fact we've got the change of usage on it from car park to sort of retail space, we've had to there's a hell of a lot of stuff. That also because it's new build as well. So things that would be the same regardless if it's a car park or a new retail space, but just like insulation, things that it's an existing building, but it was destined to be a car park. So it never needs to be heated or cooled. Needed insulation. Now we're going to be going in there and putting air source heat pumps and air conditioners and stuff in there. We've got to fit out this huge concrete box, which is theoretically quite well insulated by way of its structure. But from an EPC standard, it's all boring technical stuff. It needs to be as good as a house, essentially. But long and short of it, it's fucking expensive.
I can imagine. Because car parks are notoriously cold things.
Yeah. I think, again, we'll be all right with a lot of the space will be still unheated, still car park designated, just frankly, because we can't afford to make the whole thing like a warm greenhouse. And also we have to allow airflow through the fumes, and slightly different from fire eggs point of view as well than the current building. Whereas the kind of retail side of it, the front house, showroom, bar space, restaurant, everything will be a lot better in terms of its heating and efficiency than this place has been. The building we sat in was built in the 60s and is, a part of it was built in the 60s that we're in. And it's far from efficient, to say the least. It's the most expensive thing in the world to heat and run. So it'll pay for itself in the long run, the new place.
When you've moved in, and obviously everything still evolves and all that, do you think like will a weight drop off your shoulders of the, like this, you've always known there is an end date that's been so flexible?
So many people are coming to me being like, oh, you must be gutted, you must be heartbroken about moving. And you know what? Yeah, I've said this and I'll say this again. I do not want to be in the country the day this building comes down. Drunk on a beach somewhere, drowning my sorrows. But it was inevitable, right? We've got to be realistic and grown up about this. Yeah. We've been hugely lucky to have the stay of execution that we've had. We're kind of counting our chickens. It's been amazing. And the experiences and the journey and the adventures and the memories that have been created in the extended time alone is phenomenal, right? It's helped put us on the map. It's helped the business grow. We've met the relationships we've built and maintained as a result of that. And the impact on the community, both car-wise and local. And I can't be more grateful. So I'm realistic about it. I'm heartbroken about it, of course. But the peace of mind of having a long lease, kind of our name above the door, and not having to wait, and knowing that it has been built to a standard, I'm not going to be having to patch the roof up every winter. I'm not going to... Honestly, it's the bane of my life. And that, again, has become a full-time job for somebody else. I'm having to salary and maintain stuff, like plug holes in walls, basically. It's not been the most easy.
It's a lot of stress.
It's not been the least stressful thing in the world. It's been, quite a lot. I think for my own sanity, it'd be quite nice to be able to just ease into it. And it means I can apportion more focus onto the stuff that I do enjoy doing more. There's nothing enjoyable about dealing with tenants phoning you in the middle of the night saying, oh, my roof's leaking. And no, I'm not knocking it either. Like, fair play, the roof's leaking, we've got to deal with it. It's not their fault. But they don't want to be dealing with it either. So, I'm very excited for that peace of mind and hope it goes as well as I'm planning for it to.
Yeah. The next iteration. And then I presume you're going to keep just expanding laterally. You've got that site, but then you seem like you're always like, okay, I want to, progress this side, that side, that side. So take open all other spaces and keep the other businesses going.
So there's plans in the works to coincide with the opening of this, because we're not going to be able to replicate a lot of what we have got here. So we need some additional workshop space as an example. So we're looking actively at the moment. We found a site which should be perfect. We're in negotiations on it at the moment. It's still in Brentford for a lot more of our workshop side of things to go. Yeah. We're keeping the workshop building that we've already got on the other side of the road here, but some of the existing tenants on this side of the road, we would like to keep under our umbrella. Their tenants are independent, they can do what they want, but the nice thing about it is they're all really keen to stay with us and under our sort of tenure as well, which is great, because we've got an awesome like work community here as well. It's not just about people who visit the site, the kind of day-to-day stuff. You've got businesses that would otherwise be on an industrial estate, soulless kind of, there's no necessary relationship with their neighbours or whatever. Whereas here, everyone's integrated. Everyone does, we help each other out on jobs and socially, we always have a drink in the pub after work. It's a really nice melting pot. And it feels like we all work together, even though there's very many companies and whatever else. It's really cool. I think there's a huge push to kind of try and keep that together from the tenants, which is awesome. It's not like we're having to sort of convince them to stay or whatever. It will take some of that once we find the new space and get them to sign off on it. But the site that we found, I think, is going to be perfect for it.
Is the pub staying?
Pub stays. The developer doesn't actually own that. I mean, what happens to the pub in the long, long term remains to be seen. But the general gist of it is they won't get away with turning it into anything other than a pub, regardless of or what happens to it. So Mum still runs that. She did an amazing job of it. That's going to have a kind of a refresh over the Christmas period as well. So it's going to come back in the new year with a new food offering. It's got a new image to it as well. So I'm looking forward to that. And we've got some cool plans for it in the new year. But for the time being, that very much stays. It is going to end up being the little house in Up. Surrounded by building work.
Because is this all the site we're on now? Is that going to be sort of flats and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I think from memory, it's about 300 flats go on top of our current building. And there's people, you know, we've got a great relationship with the developer, and we would, you know, we don't want to stick any spanners in the works. And people go, oh, we should campaign to keep it. It's like, dude, they're going to put 300 flats on top of this. There's nothing monetary wise or otherwise that we can do that's going to stop this from happening. And frankly, it'll be long run for the town and the greater good. It's a benefit.
Yeah.
It's frustrating for us having to move, but the new place gives us peace of mind.
And you've been able to use this place because it was going to be developed.
Precisely. We would never have been able to afford to be in this like this footprint in this part of London, regardless, if it had been a new polished steel shed that was £30 a square foot. And forget about it.
You know, and do you think, I mean, who knows? Do you think you'll always try and stay in Brentford?
Well, what we're looking to do at the moment, in addition to opening the existing kind of stuff that we mentioned, is we want to open a site slightly further out. That's
somewhere.
Of, yeah, it, we've got a plan. I'll disclose more when I can.
Sure.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. It'd be a separate brand per se. It'll still be under Duke of London, but
something different.
Something different.
Let's get onto a little bit of cars. We live not too far from each other, and I see always see you cruising around. And I know it's you because it's an interesting car. And I don't necessarily know until you get closer, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that's Merlin in the Mustang or whatever. But I've seen an interesting coloured Ferrari cruising around. Talk to me about this, your Testarossa. Which have you had? How long have you had the Testarossa for?
Almost 2 years. Yeah, bought it in March last year.
And then, and what state did you buy it in?
It was mint. Yeah. So I spent. I wanted to buy one for my birthday at the end of March, and I must have looked hard for about 6 or 7 weeks, which for me to maintain focus on anything for 6 or 7 weeks is profound, especially when it comes to buying a car. We went to see quite a few, and I went to see what proclaimed to be the best one on the market based on its mileage and the price of it and whatever else. It was out in Birmingham. Georgia and I drove out one afternoon to have a look at it and got there, and it was an 11,000 mile car. Like UK car, really nice thing.
Super low.
Yeah. But you know, with it felt crispy.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? Driving it, it was kind of like, you couldn't fault the mileage. Like, it backed up by all the paperwork. Yeah. There was no way that car had done anything more than 11,000 miles. It was mint. But with that, to drive, it just felt like hard and cold. And I can't describe it. The seats were like, the leather was immaculate.
Yeah.
But to sit in, it was almost uncomfortable. And it rattled and squeaked, but in a way that it clearly had never been apart. Just, it was, I don't know. It just had no, it felt a bit soulless, which, I know it sounds silly because it's like a box fresh thing, but it just didn't feel right.
I didn't feel quite right.
No.
So you bought it?
No, I didn't buy that one. So
okay.
I was driving back and I said to the guy, I think about it and whatever else, and was driving back and, Georgia was with me, and she sort of had the same opinion of it. She said, like, if you feel, she didn't come out in it, the guy who owned it took me out in it. She said, if you felt like that, if it didn't warm your cockles, then it was probably not the car for you. But also, what are you going to do with it? You're going to be driving it everywhere. You're going to drive it in all weathers. You're going to, I know what you're like. I said, no, it's a really good point. There's no point in me paying what was a premium for that
a very
car.
Nice.
It was a really nice car. It was red as well, and that was the other caveat. I didn't want a red one. I didn't want a red one, and I didn't want a black one.
Yeah.
I would have considered a yellow one, but really what I wanted was like a blue or a white, or white was like peak, but there was none available at the time, and I was just hugely impatient. So I went to see kind of all the ones that proclaimed to be good that were on the market at that point. And as we were driving back from seeing this car in Birmingham, I was just flicking through eBay, and one picked up. Picked one up on a classified ad on eBay, just one photo of it, sat in the showroom down at Autofficina in Epsom, and just said, just arrived, details coming soon.
Yeah.
It was a left-hand drive. I could see it was a Eurospec car, late 90 car, so it's five lug wheels and the two mirrors. But it done, what it done at the time, 25,000 kilometers, I think. So again, really low mileage, but had been in Japan, bit of a gap in the history. It was a really nothing horrific either, but just by comparison to the other car, it wasn't the kind of box fresh thing that the other one pretended to be. It had an aftermarket exhaust on it already, which was something I was going to do regardless. It saved me a fortune. And phoned them.
So you're like, well, where's the original exhaust? I'm going to take some money off.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I phoned them, and it was Friday afternoon, and they said, look, we shut at 6. So I will be there at 6, but I promise you, I'm not wasting your time. Never dealt with them before. I kind of knew the son of the owner a little bit from our car meets, so they stayed open for us. went to see it, yeah, went out for a drive. And at this point, I had, I'd broken my right arm, so it was left-hand drive car. And miraculously, and Lewis, to your credit, thank you very much for this, but he let me test drive. And I was shifting gears with my right arm in a left-hand drive car, which is how I had to drive it for the first few months of owning it, till my arm plate.
Sounds safe.
Yeah, it was really safe. I mean, it did like 10,000 kilometers like that. And we went back and forth on the price. They had it on sale or return. And annoyingly, I wanted to take it home that day. I'm really impatient when it comes to my own stuff. Customer cars from buying site for stock, I can buy it with a cold heart. Yeah. I'm the worst for buying. I shouldn't admit this. I'm the worst for buying my own cars. I just have to have it. So we went back and forth on the price. The guy who owned it was on holiday in South America. They couldn't get hold of him, time difference, whatever else. And I was just like, oh, God, really? Oh, okay. So I left him with an offer and said, look, just call me once you've, once you got, heard back from him. We had some interaction from the guy, but he'd gone offline. And he said, I'm not taking less than X amount. And I'd offer them a little bit less. Yeah. Left them with the offer. Got to, from them to the Kingston roundabout in, what's all of 3/4 of a mile up the road. And Georgia was in silence. I was like, what? Yeah, what have I done wrong now? You're an idiot. Like, what do you mean? It's a dealership. It's going to come with a warranty. It's the nicest one. It's clearly the one that makes you happy. It's got the exhaust on it you want. And you're going to lose it over what was $2,000. Yeah. I was just like, call the guy back. So I did. And I went back and I paid him what they wanted for it. And I picked it up the next day. And it was just best day ever. I was so this is a car that I'd wanted non-stop. It's one of the few cars I can hand on heart say that I've never gone out of like kind of the love with the idea of something. Certainly it was the only one at the time that I could afford. So I thought, this is going to be it. I have to do it. And I had a sort of silly goal in my head. I wanted one before I was 30, and I bought it on my 28th birthday and was like, I've got to do this. That has been with me since March last year. We've done all sorts with it. We went straight off the first summer all over Europe in it, got it back. And then at the beginning of this year, we drove it to the ice in St. Moritz. Incredible event. Skis on the roof, very posy.
I was looking at Instagram nonsense videos and stuff from that recently.
I need to get there. You have to come out in Feb. It's just balmy. It's that kind of, we do eccentricity organically and really like naturally. I feel like we completely misjudge just how well they can do it on the continent as well. The kind of, it blows my mind. The amount of production that's gone into what is realistically quite a small event.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. You've got like back flipping ice skating waiters making you a martini. And you're like, this is great. It's a great place to just people watch, look at the cars and just get pissed for the afternoon.
It looks sick.
Watch these guys drift their 250 GTOs and stuff around the lake. And you're like, this is...
Like, what is this?
It's a real pinch yourself kind of ordeal. Quick credit to the team that put that on. We went out for that. And then on the way home, I got it seized by the French police, which was fun. And that was a whole ordeal in itself. But going back to what I said about the first car I went to, the other car I went to look at that day, I bought this one. I didn't want a red one. And this is a red car, black interior.
Yeah.
Really nice car. Been really well looked after. Been owned by a guy who I knew of, like a sort of prominent Ferrari collector in the UK for about 12, 13 years. He'd brought it in from Japan. People get funny about the Japanese import stuff, but usually it means it's been... meticulously
they've got
maintained.
No documents because they don't keep it. No. But like,
so this was the gap in the history. So I had early stuff, and there was this sort of that 10-year gap in the history with Japan. But the car's pristine and it's faultless. I would say faultless. It's still a Ferrari, but
yeah.
So I kind of weighed up for the fact that fine, it's a red car, but ultimately it's kind of one of the few Ferraris I feel can get away with being red.
Yeah.
And kind of convinced myself it was the right thing to do, but always wanted to change it. Thanks to Litchfield earlier this year, they took it on.
Now, what made you choose them?
So, price being the main factor, I'd say. The team, they were great. Dealt with Riley. Ian was lovely too. And they did an awesome job. I mean, frankly, the job they've done...
It looks sick.
...is insane. You would not... I mean, so PPS, for those who don't know, is like peelable paint protection spray, they call it. There's other companies that offer it in the UK as well, but essentially they spray down a peelable PPF base coat on top of your original paint. So they get your original paint detailed into the nines. They have to strip off any coating. So my car was ceramic coated, so they have to polish all that off, get it to the best possible finish on its original paint, then spray this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring.
At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, clear plastic PPF, whatever. I don't think it's actually clear when they put the colour on it, but they put this PPF spray on it and then paint it over the top.
Like yeah, they should just paint it, basically, yeah. Don't they?
So everyone's going, oh, it looks like paint. It's like, well, it is paint, but it's so difficult to try and explain it to people because it's a wrap. And I'm like, it's not, okay, it's fine. But the finish on it is that of paint because it is paint on top of this peelable base coat. And when you're done with it or whatever, they warranty it for 3 years. They reckon, I don't think they've had one done for 7 or 8 years, but they reckon it's good for 7 or 8 years. And we'll see. But it's about, for the amount of work that goes into strip and refit, and fair play to them, they've also said they'll never do another Testarossa for this price. I think they said their strip and fit guy nearly walked out over it. And what was supposed to be a 5-week thing took a little bit longer. But I know I didn't really have to, I didn't want to chase them because I knew, like,
okay,
there's no way they're going to get a price.
In 5 weeks. Thank you much.
Yeah. I mean, they were really good about it. It went up a little bit, the price, but that was more than fair for the job that they did. Went back and forth with me. I think we had about 25 different spray outs of different shades of different colors. At one point it was going to be pink, and they did a really, really cool blend of two shades of Ferrari Nocciola. So hazelnut, metallic brown. It's sort of bronze in some lights, gold in others, chocolate brown at night.
What was the inspiration?
The inspiration, the Parmigiani
for the color.
So actually, funny enough, it was at the ice. The first year I went to the ice, the year before last, there was, Andrea Parmigiani's got a 250 Lusso in Nocciola. In that, there's about somewhere between 7 and 13 shades of Nocciola that Ferrari did out the factory. And there's so little information by way of color codes and things like that available online. So you look at a lot of the cars that out there that purport to be that color, and you're like, well, that's orange and that one's brown.
Yeah, they're not the same.
No, but it sort of varies era to era. But this Lusso is 250 Lusso. Oh my God. And on the lake in the light, Alex Penfold got an amazing set of photos of it. And I just kept going back to this and kept going back to this. And I dropped him a line on Instagram, and I said, he was really helpful with what, he spoke to his dad and found out exactly kind of what the shade was that they'd had the car done in. And really, really huge thanks to them for that. Went back to Litchfield and finally mixed up two different variants. So we went for a blend of what their car is and one of the other kind of factory variants. Blown away with it. George, I'm colorblind so badly. So I had to. Georgia was like, what do you think of that? She's like, that's like, look, green. I'm like, no, it doesn't. Oh, okay, if it does, it does. it came out really well. And again, it's sort of gold in direct sunlight.
Yeah.
And then it's bronze in kind of daylight, it's dark brown at night, and I'm really, really,
I've seen it around and it absolutely fits that car.
It's weird that they never did that. They did one Marone car, like a dark sort of maroon brown, maroon brown, you know what I'm trying to say, which sold at RM Pebble year before last for an obscene amount of money. I think about £300,000, otherwise standard Testarossa, but in that brown, mulberry brown sort of thing. And that kind of didn't suit it. It was almost a dull, and it was a color I was going to do this because it was a Testarossa color theoretically with the one they made from factory, but it didn't really suit it. It looked a little bit slab sided. It was quite a dull,
didn't quite work.
No,
for some reason,
whereas this is quite bling, and I think that lends itself quite well to that cliche 80s, noise that
it's
of
bling,
the design of it,
but it's also brown, so it's like it's not in your face.
And I think the only thing I can say that sort of I was like, about is I kind of wanted to wind people up with it.
Okay, yeah.
But the reaction from everyone, or even on the like Ferrari chat forums and stuff, has been phenomenal. Everyone's like, it looks amazing. I'm like, thank you, but yeah.
Maybe I'll do it fluorescent yellow next.
it's been really, really lovely actually, the comments we've had on the car. So really happy with how it came out. But now it's gone full circle where, yes, I bought it and I've been not precious about driving it. And I feel like, oh, I can't use it in the snow. but yeah, I love that car.
Oh, it looks sick. In terms of things coming in and things going out in here, are you seeing any sort of trends? What's going up? What's going down? General market.
Market's on its arse. And it's no point of sitting here and waxing lyrical about it. It's not beyond viable to still sell a car by any stretch. I think it's just where we saw stuff getting hyperinflated through COVID. And you could kind of foresee a lot of it coming. Things like, you know, people with silly backdate 911s and stuff like that, you know, who would do such...
Well, sold.
Yeah, no, I know I did. Well done. I think you did well. Not be rude, but I think you did well to get out of that. Like, yeah. That market, your car was a really, really, really good car, in my opinion. But there were so many things trying to be your, like, not your car per se, but that kind of caliber of...
cars that are sort of, on paper, the same. And I'd say mine was, like, quite a nice one, but it still had... You know, they've all got their issues and whatever, and there's just so much stuff that's the same. Yeah. So it's very difficult to distinguish.
But I think what's distinguishing about your car, or what was your car, is the fact that it'd been built and it'd been documented and it was done to a proper standard. Whereas a lot of these guys are sending like 3-litre SCs or 3.2 Carreras to body shops and just, you know, going to design 911, buying some panels and whacking them on and going, oh, backdate. And you're like, yeah, fair enough. Like, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But you can't then put $120,000 price tag on it. It doesn't. Yeah. That doesn't
you don't have it. A name.
No. And behind it. Yeah, and it also, if you're not upgrading the engine or the suspension and the brakes with it as well, it's still a non-original. Yeah, yeah. In my mind, it's actually worth less than a Carrera or whatever.
That's, I think, for me, one of the things that was happening. And I sold that car because I just wasn't using it. And I sort of went, if I'd liquidated the cash in it, like, one, would I keep this car for 20 years? And financially, is it going to do anything over 20 years? I was like, no, it's not whatsoever. If I liquidate the money now, would I buy it again right now? And the answer was no, because I just don't use it. And I've used it a lot and had the fun and whatnot. But it does feel like a funny sort of those cars. It does feel like a funny time. Like now you kind of go, well, they are what they are.
Yeah.
They're always going to sort of be worth some money, but at the same time, they're never going to be worth
but equally,
loads.
Your car meant a lot to you. You chose the colours. You went on a build process with that. The notion you're buying someone's thing that might have projector headlights that you don't like, or they might have a centre fuel cap on the bonnet which you don't like, or there's such a person. Because there's a plethora of parts available for them, and you know the options are limitless. You're building something that's so tailored. It's like trying to sell your tailored suit to somebody else. It's still worth something because it's got the badge in it, but it's not going to be to everyone's, you're not going to tick every box for someone.
And that's why I think we're seeing, it's definitely with the higher end stuff, because you can go to so many people that will build you and like a really nice car, whatever you want, and do it really well. But I think we're seeing a trend towards, and it's something I've been chatting to some people about, is basically if you're the person making it, kind of make a product. We've seen it with Singer, et cetera, et cetera. Like make a product that people know what it is. And then if you want to change it a little bit for the customers, fine, happy days. But when they come to sell it, people know what it is.
They don't have to explain it.
They don't have to explain it. You go, oh, it's a Singer, not a 964 that's got a carbon body and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And if you want to do the carbon body 964, cool, but be prepared that it's your car and whatever you're spending on it, you're losing.
Yeah, right? You're never getting
it
back.
You've got to take it on the chin. Like, whatever. Or you built yourself a 911K with Tuthill. Or you know what it is then. You know, it's got a badge to it. It's got a name to it.
It's funny, like that, it was the 911K. I don't know whether they were originally, I don't think they planned to build more when they started the process. And then they did it because Philip is mad and was like, let's do this. It's going to be sick. And then you get to the end. So it started as one of those projects that was like, I just want to make this.
Mm.
And then they kind of branded it, not for any particular reason.
No, that's kind of what makes it cool.
It's like literally just like, it's his car. And then they've gone, but you can have one the same. And it's become a product. So people go, well, I want a 911K, which is kind of funny in itself because
But with that, it's become, and I think as well, given you've only got to watch one video about it online, mm. the Chris Harris video on it, and you can't help but want one. And then you kind of come out the other end of it, and you've created, as you rightfully say, a car that sits up there with Singer in terms of not having to have an introduction, not having to be justified. Yeah, they're eye-wateringly expensive, but no one cares. They can see straight past that.
It's an amazing example of quite a cool concept, executed well, and then delivered through social media, etc. Like that Chris Harris video, that's one of the best automotive videos I've seen in a long time.
Yeah,
just because it just hits you, and you're like, I actually, after that, went, I don't think I want to own that car. Like, it looks, I'd love to drive it, but I don't think I want to own it. It's like a bit, I think it's a bit too rowdy for like what I want out of a car. If I handed you like a somewhat unlimited budget, let's just say an unlimited budget for a project that you're like, I would love to do, that's, you know, like 911K or whatever. What is there anything in your mind that you're like, I would really love to just to do X, Y, Z, ignoring the financials?
It's not like I've got a couple of things in build at the moment. So we're building an Alfa Giulia Super that I've had quite a nice, you know, build process with, but it's a bit bittersweet story. I sold it to a friend of mine who sadly took his own life a couple of years ago. And when I did sell it to him initially, we always had the agreement that I would have first refusal. And yeah, fair play to, bless her, his lovely wife Kate, she honoured that agreement, and I bought it back off of her. We had always joked, Charles and I, who had owned the car, we'd always joked that we would, let's do this and let's do this. I built the car to a fast road spec. It had 180 horsepower, 2 litre Nord in it, built by an amazing engineer up in Norfolk called Titus Rowlandson. Norfolk or Suffolk? He'll hate me for getting that wrong. and then all the alcoholic stage 2 suspension bits. And so I built it to kind of a point. I didn't want to spend 40 grand on titanium alcoholic suspension bits because the car was worth less than that. I couldn't afford to. But we built this kind of real riotous thing. But we always joke, I'd build the alcoholic GTA R-Spec, you know, twin spark for it, and I'd do it this color, and I'd do. And now I bought the car back. I've decided, actually, again, inspired by another great piece of automotive journalism, Henry Catchpole did a video on the Super that alcoholics did build, the dark silver car. And again, watch that. Phone Titus immediately. I was like, right, get on the phone to alcoholics. We're building this engine. But he's like, what the fuck? Your engine's done 3,000 miles. Nothing wrong with it. So I've got another mate of ours wants to buy the engine. That's fine. That's sold. That'll part fund the price. You're fucking mental. There's nothing wrong with the car. And so we've now done a massive strip down on the car. We've smoothed out a lot. It was debumpered, but we've smoothed out the front end of it. We've done da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But long and short of what your question was, that's a car that I'd always wanted to build.
Yeah.
I'd love a 911K. I can't afford a 911K. So I found a 72 Targa US spec car, UK registered in Malta during lockdown. Weird whole conundrum of events led to us finding this car. I didn't have the money at the time. She bought the car for herself. It needed an engine rebuild. It went to the wrong person to do a load of work on it. Long story short, we got it back. It was in pieces, blah, blah, blah. And she had had, when we were growing up, she had a 911E, 69 911E, and she had a 3.2 Carrera cab that she'd sold to sort of help us through school or whatever else. So I sort of felt morally obliged to help her out with this car. So I sent the engine off the boys at Tuthill, who were building a hot 2.7 to kind of RS Plus spec, maybe about 240, 250 horsepower. MFI lump with their Rally X-Pipe exhaust on it, and it's got the K&N stack filters on it as well, so it's going to sound awesome. Should pull like a train. Wevo shifter on the 915 and uprated suspension and brakes. And whilst I can't afford the 911K, we've now gone down the route of we're doing the whole body in carbon. The only thing that I'm going to have to, I can't not buy, is their 911K steering wheel. It's just one of the most beautiful things ever made. That flax carbon.
Flax carbon, yeah. It's sort of RSR style.
So. Yeah, exactly. So we've done...
Their steering wheels. I've sat in two cars that I've gone, these are some of the nicest steering wheels. And one was that car, 911K. And I think you can just buy their steering wheel. And the other was, it was a very similar design, but more modern, in the that Rally Singer thing they built. That was like a kind of modern version of the same thing.
It's
so nice.
It's a Yeti thing. So yeah, that's a long way. So what we're having the engine, it will all be on that, yeah, the lovely amber engine, what do you call it? The engine tinware, sorry. So in that lovely amber weave, fiberglass, and it's going to look really cool. So that car's coming along, but we're going to run it initially. We're going to run the engine in. We're going to bolt the engine. All the brakes and suspension are already fitted to what's the donor shell, which is still a rolling shell at the moment. We're going to bolt the engine in as the car is. So it's a real patinaed California car.
Yeah.
But it's going to have this silly Larry Tuttle lump and all this suspension on it. So I'll run it for the first part of next year while we're paying to build the showroom.
Yeah.
And then the plan is to strip it at the end of next year, and we'll do a full carbon body on it and everything else. So we're going to shape, it's going to have like Lexan windows, but even the rear windscreen. I've got a guy, Neil Meliard at ProSign, who's going to fake the heated rear windscreen element in pinstriping by hand. I want it to look completely stock.
Yeah.
But be this like lightweight thing. So we should shave about 200 kilos out of the weight of the car.
So that's quite interesting. Like, those are both projects that probably make no financial sense whatsoever.
But they're also a lot cheaper because we're doing it in the trade, and I'm, you know, whilst all the internals on the Alphas engine, for instance, I didn't get this. So the engine that we're building is inspired by the car Henry drove. So that's going to be sort of 2.2 twin spark Alphaholics internal. So we're buying all the parts from Alphaholics, but I'm never going to, can't ever say it's an Alphaholics GTAR. And frankly, it doesn't matter because it's not going to cost me 300 grand to build it. But you're right, it makes no financial sense whatsoever. These are two very much passion project cars. Obviously, the Porsche is still very much for my mum.
Yeah.
It's just what she wanted. She's like, I'm not going to have to drive this fucking thing. I'm not. I've been a bit selfish with that. I think she appreciates it. I hope she does. The only other thing that's not in process that, again, wouldn't make financial sense, I would love to put the testosterone throttle bodies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just because. I mean, it was done quite regularly, especially in Japan in the like, 90s and noughties. And the internals on the bottom end are so strong. They're 380 horsepower, so, but you can, with a Motec on there, you can push them to just shy of 500 horsepower without any sort of mechanical modification.
I did a podcast with an Italian guy, completely failing my mind, who built a Restomod Testarossa.
The white one.
The white
one. Yeah, it's a cool car. I know the company you mean. I don't know the name of it.
I can't remember what it's called.
Good looking car.
And they did, their engine, I think, was like 500 or something.
But
like
it's
that.
All stock internals. They're so hyper rated. And you look at the Koenig specials and stuff, the turbocharged cars, the entry level turbo cars were stock internals the whole way through. They're strong that they can take it. You don't, touch wood, it'll be me that blows one up, but you don't hear of it. Testarossa's fuel system electric's fine, but the bottom ends or top ends don't usually give way. That's something I'd love. If I end up keeping that car forever, that's something I'd love to do.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? You go like, well, this would be nice, but I have to stop at some point, and like I have to be somewhat sensible in some way, shape or form over time, but where does that line go? Who knows? Over time, I think it just keeps growing.
Yeah. And you get more and more ambitious. And I think one thing that I've been massively guilty of is you kind of do build these things and then go, right, what's next?
Yeah.
And you don't spend enough time actually appreciating it as a car. Mm. So I'm trying to sort of rein it in a bit and be like, no. That's why we've gone to build it to the end. I think there's a big part of that that's been made up by getting a project to a point where it becomes like you spend as much as you can or want to on it. But you kind of know, niggling in the back of your head, oh, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd done that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can never fully, and whether it'll make a difference to the end result to the point that's going to appease that inner curiosity, probably not. But with that Alpha as an example, we are doing everything to, there's not going to be anything like that's left wishing we'd done more to, which I'm quite excited about because I think it should fly that car.
Yeah, the final, because I remember you, I feel like it was that one, who I was talking about Alphas with you, and you were like, oh, I've got this Alpha that we've been messing with a bit, and it's an absolute riot. I presume it's the same car.
Yeah. I mean, that was like with 180 horsepower, so with 230, 240, it should be quite fun. I'm quite looking forward to it.
I think it will be. I think this is probably quite a good point to sort of start wrapping things up and keep people hanging on for a bit more. You've done the five car questions quite a few times, so I'll dial it back. What do you think is the most, what's undervalued? Is there anything undervalued at the moment? Anything taking a dip or that you're like, Yeah. Actually, that makes it interesting again.
Well, there's a lot of stuff out there that I think is coming off the boil that, you know, for whatever reason, be it they were hyperinflated through COVID prices, E-types at the moment, you know, no Series 1 3.8, you know, outside locking bonnet or not, in my head, is a 200 grand car. Yeah. It's just a knot. They made hundreds of thousands of these things. Whereas at kind of 80 grand for a really nice Series 1, that's a cool car. That's something you're like, well, actually. Or at 50 grand for a 4.2 US spec Series 1, you're going, well, hang on, that's a hell of a lot of car for the money. So that's something that's kind of piqued my curiosity. Things like R107 SLs, they're coming up. They're massively coming up, but I still think that they're massively undervalued. When you look at, they're still a third of the price of a Pagoda, and they're daily drivable. And with that, the 129s that then followed it, I think because of the way ULEZ has hit those, in London especially, we haven't got any in stock anymore because we just can't sell them for the money that everyone wants for them. Yeah. They'll come back, but for the time being, what's a really nice 18 to 20 grand car 2-3 years ago is now a 12 grand car, and you're like, what? This is crazy. Like, quad cam V8 in it, and doesn't make any sense to me, but I think they represent really, really good value at the moment. Stuff that I think, this is with a sort of selfish motivation, I really want a Bentley Supersports, the first gen 2010 car. I was driving to see one 2 weeks ago, got 20 minutes away from the guy's house. He fucking phoned me and went, oh, sorry, I sold it.
What are they now?
35.
That's a lot of car.
That's a lot of car for the money.
And they don't go, I feel like they don't go that wrong. I feel like if they do go wrong, it's expensive, but I don't think they go that wrong. The engine's pretty solid.
Yeah, the engine's great. It's things like sensors and modules and stuff. But where the lot of the sort of 14, 15 grand Continental GTs are an absolute liability to inherit because they've been cheap for a long time and difficult then to, disproportionately expensive to maintain. They haven't been maintained properly. Mm-hmm. The Supersports is almost immune from that. It's the latest sort of facelift of that first gen. And so with that, it's got a lot of improvements over the sort of 2006, 2007 cars. But moreover, because they were so expensive to buy, none of them have done 100,000 miles. They've all done 30 to 60 at a push.
One owner.
Yeah, quite. And most of them have got full Bentley history because they're still worth a bit of money. Most of them have been meticulously maintained and really well looked after. And there's not a lot of options on them. So I want a GT, not a GTC, and I want the two-seater options, the two bucket seats out the Veyron with the rear strap brace. But there was one passed up on eBay, again, sort of private seller, classified ad last week. I just missed out. Literally, clearly he was bombarded, but he put up for 30 grand and it sold immediately with 60,000 miles on it. Seven owner car, 60,000 miles, loads of history. But that's like for 30 grand. That's just obscene. That's a crazy amount. It's not even like Golf GTI money anymore. So I think they've got, in the years to come, I think they should be heralded as. I was speaking to Mike Sayer from Bentley about this, and whether I should say what he said or not, but he said it's the best car that they've made because it's just so versatile in terms of everything it did. And for the money it costs now, it's like it's incomparable. Yeah. The new Conti GT is a whole other level. It's like one of the best cars I've ever driven.
I really like the new ones.
Me too. But then we're talking
about a car that's more expensive.
Nearly 15% of the price.
Yeah.
The guys at the factory all said that was their car. That was the one that they were most proud
nice.
Of. Which is, I think that's a good thing to kind of own as
well.
Yeah,
that is cool. With the new ones, I remember when they came out, they didn't have, it lost the image. The previous one had an image at that time of like real like footballer type. Whereas the new one has now, in my eyes, has never had that. And I looked at it and went, right, okay, these are 150, 60, 70, whatever they are new, 200 or something. Okay, in about 5 years' time, they should be about 40.
And they're still 130
grand. So, 100% I'll have one.
Yeah.
And they're not.
I think it backs up what you said about the image. The image is going to be completely, fair play to Bentley, they've completely rebranded that as a model. No one's knocking it anymore. It's not an ugly duckling. It's a very pretty car. But to drive, it's like driving a 911 Turbo. They're so fast. It's not as agile, of course, but it's like they're so quick. They're so comfy.
The interior is so nice.
It's the best interior of a modern car.
I think it is, yeah.
And they've done a really good job
with that.
With that
spinning screen as well.
So cool. You just can't help keep pushing the button.
Yeah. And then when you put it away and you just get the two clocks or three clocks, you're like, I remember the first time I saw that and thought, this is the only car of this era that is not going to like date horrifically in 10 years' time, because you could just flip away the screen and you won't see it. Whereas now you look in a car and you see whatever box is in it.
I know it shares the same moniker, but it couldn't be, in my opinion, more different in terms of its representation than the original Conti GT. No. It's profound that they're even the same model. I know they've got the same silhouette and the same underpinnings, but yeah, they're not the same car.
It's funny, they've done
such a great job with that.
Those have got to come down.
But they're genuinely, for a nice spec, you know, kind of Mulliner or whatever else, they really are still 130, 140 yeah. grand. And yeah, fine, they're 200 grand new. So whoever's taken a bath on the depreciation really has.
Okay, but another car that is in that space, if you have bought a new 911 turbo in the last year or two,
sorry, yeah, I feel for you. Yeah,
for like 185 grand or 100 or 200 or whatever they are, you can now go and buy one with not very many miles on it for in the 140s.
Yeah, I mean, there's cars in the trade available for 120, 130,
which is insane. Yeah,
that's mental, right? And you look at what the 991 Gen 2 Turbo S's and turbos are trading for. It's not a lot less. And I actually prefer the look of the Gen 2 991 iteration of it than the current.
I do like the new one, though.
The new ones are just insane. That's
a car. Now, I need to somehow disconnect myself from, because I got my GTS and I kind of still wanted that. But when they came through to say, do you still want it? You know, here's your build slot. I was aware that you could buy, at that point in time, turbos in the 60s, and I didn't want a turbo. But it was already in my mind that, like, hang on, there's some value here. And this is a lesson I will take forward. I like my car, and I'm probably keep it for a while because it was sort of what I wanted. But this is me defending the purchase for a silly price. But my radar of value, which was on when I ended up buying my 812, when they were like 220, 210 to 220 was get you any 812. I was like, this feels like a lot of value, which I think you only get from sort of watching and experiencing them all. Yeah. Babe. My turbo value now is going, if I hadn't bought my car, I think I would be either in the next 6 months would be buying a turbo for 1.4 something or 1.3 something and going, well, there's no way it's going to be worth 100 grand. It's like a 1 year old car that is a 200 grand car. They've got to come back up.
Yeah. It's one of the only models alongside the Taycan that you can walk into Porsche West London this afternoon and drive out with one. Because they just can't get rid of them. And you know, we're not far off the Gen 2s being announced and whatever else. And
which could be a hybrid and whatever.
Regardless of what it is, it's still going to push the value of these ones down. Yeah. It's a bit of a great car for the money. When they do hit 100 grand, which they will, that's just like unbelievable amount of car.
And that car, you get so many owners that spec them insanely. Yeah. They're like, oh, well, it's the turbo. So Turbo S, so I'll get the Burmester. I'll tick all of the options. It's got ceramics, etc. And then you'll look at it and go, well, if I wanted to buy a new Carrera, it's going to cost me 15 grand more
than buying a
two-year-old Turbo S.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. Final question. Five-car garage, unlimited value, you've got to fit into your life.
Changes every time you ask me this. This week,
on this day,
five car garage would be right. Let's think this through. I would love a 4-cam 275. That's probably the third time I've said this on here.
Yeah,
that's like
so. There's a consistency in that one. Yeah,
if it wasn't that, it would be an iteration of it. I would like a CLK GTR, Roadster, just for posing. Where else are we? I think I'd have to keep the Testarossa just because I love it. I've never bonded with a car like that before. That's staying. What else? Something silly and sort of fun, pre-war-y.
Okay.
Yeah, blow a Bentley.
Something or other.
Yeah. Type 35 Bugatti, that sort of thing. There's your fourth and one left. Is there anything modern in that? Not really.
Have you got anything that's like reliable?
No, don't anyway.
Whether you need anything. Do you need anything reliable?
Just have enough of them. You just keep rotating. Yeah. Ask me how I know. Maybe something sort of more modern than fun and fast. I think, and this isn't necessarily something that, it's not really a five-car garage car, but on that, just to conclude the podcast, I think P1s have aged better than anything else.
Incredibly.
Oh my God. Sam Fain put up a video of a black one that he's been driving around in Australia, I think, at the moment. And you look at that car and the way it sits and its aero mode. And it, oh my Lord, that is one of the best looking cars ever made. So yeah, one of those. There you go. Five.
Yeah. I think that era of car, the hybrids, 918, LAF, etc., P1, they are, I think, to maintain now. I think the P1s are getting easier because there's other companies.
They're still not a reliable car in that car carriage.
Yeah. You've got five. Yeah. One might start. The testosterone will work.
Yeah, that's been pretty good.
Sometimes. They seem to have a ticking time bomb, things like the P1 and stuff, in terms of ongoing maintenance costs because of all these hybrid powertrains. I wonder what that will happen to them long term, whether people with like LAFs and stuff. I mean, does the hybrid even work in a LAF? I don't know. I'm sure it does, but like, would removing it benefit? Probably. Yeah. I wonder if that's like a thing that aftermarket people will do at some point in time, because the SP3 is basically a similar or slightly evolved with engine, but without hybrid. And everyone's like, I'll pay more for that.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? SP3 is car six. And the other thing that I've just thought of is the Maserati big thing. Am I having a brain fart moment?
Old?
The Enzo Maserati. Wow.
Oh, MC12.
MC12. Jesus Christ. It's too early in the morning, Sam. It's at least 12 o'clock. Yeah, MC12. Yeah, you have to have an MC12 in there.
That's a cool thing.
It's just obscenely ridiculous.
They are.
It's a no rhyme or reason car.
Interesting.
I like that.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. I think there's...
MC12 and then skin it in a different colour.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Because I don't actually like them in
like
the...
Like a yellow
white,
or
yeah, quite. It's something silly.
Or whatever you want to do.
But yeah, the SP3, as you say, is sort of almost the same underpinnings per se, but without that to worry about. Although that said, with the Lanzanti doing what they're doing with all the P1s, I think that will future proof them to an extent. Porsche is probably the one that's never going to go wrong, he says. The Ferrari stuff, there's just going to be millions of pounds for them to make to keep them going, surely. Yeah, I'm sure the aftermarket network of people looking after them will.
I wonder if there will be a line for some collectors and stuff in terms of. Because like race cars have hit a point where you can't run the hybrid. When they started going hybrid, it's like, nah, we spent 100 million running that for a year. Do you really want to run that? You're like, probably not. Let's disable all of that stuff. And I wonder if there will be a line in the sand of modern crazy stuff where anything that's hybrid kind of almost becomes like a, okay, you can run it, but
yeah.
Whereas everything before that, you can run it with one person and not too much issue. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
Good to have a great chat.
Nice to see you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.